Here we go. Welcome to BP WrigleyCast, a Cubs podcast that looks at the game from both the analytical and the fan's point of view. This is episode 8, and we're all very excited tonight because we have our very first guest. So, as usual, we've got Isaac Bennett, Ryan Davis, Joel Reese, and joining us today is Kat Garcia.
Yay!
Hey, everyone.
Hey.
Welcome.
So Kat, she writes, she's a staff writer for BP Wrigleyville, BP Southside, and a contributor for Hardball Times. Kat, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you guys for having me.
Great. So today we're gonna go through. We've got one more week of spring training, and then we start with the real baseball games. So we figured it'd be a good time to look at all the teams in the NL Central, and we'll preview them. So each one of us is going to take a team, and let's just jump right in. We're going to start with the Brewers. So Joel, what do you got for us?
Well, I looked at the Brewers, and I began my article. I don't want to give away too much here because I know our tens of listeners are dying to get a hold of this story. But I talked about how in 2011, they really went for it, and they traded Lorenzo Cain. I had forgotten about that, but they traded him and a bunch of players for Sean Markham and Zach Greinke, and they went for it, and they didn't win, and it's just been kind of an inexorable slide down from there, culminating in last season's 68-94 disaster. So they did the smart thing. They've kind of following the Cubs model in that they brought in a numbers guy. Their GM, when they hired him, David Stearns, was 30 years old, which is insane to me. I mean, when I was 30, I wasn't quite living in my parents' basement, but metaphorically, I probably still was. But and so he's kind of obliterated the team and started over, and he traded a bunch of players. He traded, I guess he wasn't on when they traded Aramis Ramirez, but since last season they've traded Jonathan Broxton, Chris Davis, Mike Fears, Giovanni Gallardo, Adam Lind, Gerardo Parra, Gene Segura, Francisco Rodriguez, and they really backed up the truck and they're starting over, and which is, you know, I mean, they don't have Theo Epstein, so you know, how it worked out remains to be seen, but their 2015 draft was rated by one website as the third best in baseball. Number two was the Cubs, by the way.
Which was that JoelReese.com?
Yeah. Yes, it was. It's .biz, actually. And so they backed up the truck, and they brought in a bunch of players. They brought just kind of reading off some names here. Chris Carter, all he does is catch touchdowns. All this guy does is hit homers. He's hit 90 homers over the last 3 years, which is tied for eighth in the majors, but he struck out 151 times last year. So I don't know that he's the answer at first, but he does swing a mean bat. One of the most intriguing players, this guy named Brett Phillips, who's a center fielder. They got him in the Carlos Gomez trade. He is, I don't know if you've seen the videos of this guy laughing. It's hilarious. He starts laughing, and then he just freezes, and you think the camera stopped moving. And then occasionally he lets out these, like, donkey-like brays. Like, and it's really funny. But he's also, like, a five-tool player. So hit 15 homers and had a 268 ISO for the Astros High A team. Ison Diaz is a shortstop that he got for Gene Segura. He looks promising. And then the number one prospect is this guy, Orlando Arcia, who was ranked sixth overall by MLB.com. He's also a shortstop, but they're really excited about him in Milwaukee. They feel like they're kind of looking forward to him, like he's, you know, kind of the Chris Bryant of their era. Although, you know, not that kind of caliber of player, obviously, but they're just very excited. I mean, you know, when Bryant came up, everyone was excited too. So, you know, they don't have, their pitching is questionable. They've signed Matt Garza. They've got a couple more years left of him.
My guy.
Yeah, he's your guy. No offense, no offense, Ryan. But he wasn't great last year, and you know, they've got some. Basically, they've got a bunch of guys. to kind of sum it up, I feel like if everything breaks their way, they could be right around 500. So that's
so optimistic.
Yeah, that's about it. But they're the thing is they're making the right moves, you know. And I was looking at Pecota, and Pecota has exactly two players on the team higher than 1.5 warp. One is Ryan Braun, we all know. He is kind of starting to slide. His back is acting up again. And, you know, he's on the hook until 2020. And then the other guy is Justin LaCroix, who is a catcher, and I will buy you a case of Spotted Cow if he's on the team at the All-Star break. So there's some, you know, everyone is waiting for them to trade him, and they probably will. So I think they're just starting over with youth, and they're on the right track, but they've got a ways to go. I would say they're a couple years away from really being a threat, but they are making the right moves.
How many wins do you have them for?
I have them for 77.
Okay. Yeah. So you wrote the preview. I have to ask, did you use any good quotes from any articles that anyone who covered the Brewers in Arizona?
Well, as a matter of fact, Ryan, I did. I used a quote from Matt Garza talking about how they're trying to create a culture of winning. And it was this really brilliant piece. I can't quite remember who wrote it. Do you have any ideas?
Yeah, if you just, you know, if you just cite that in your article, I'm sure that'd be fine. No, give credit.
I always do. to my mind, it was a little counterintuitive to be looking to Matt Garza for any sort of positive clubhouse element. But he's turned over a new leaf from his mercurial days as a pitcher throwing the ball away on the way to first as a Cub.
Yeah, no, I think there's some good quotes in there about him feeling like he's now one of the veteran leaders, whereas even, I guess, just up until like a year or so ago, he still thought of himself as like one of the young guys who had to look to veterans for leadership. So at least in his own mind, he thinks that it's time for him to be more mature and take the lead.
Yeah. So we'll see. I mean, like I said, he's now discovering. I think maybe everyone's looking at Jake Arrieta and seeing how he's doing Pilates and yoga, and everyone's kind of emulating that. And he's talking about Pilates and yoga. So maybe he comes back. But I mean, you know, he's had shoulder issues. He's older. How old is he? 30, 31?
I think he's 31 or 32.
And so, yeah.
And I think that's been a focus for the entire team for the Brewers, because when I was out there, I went out to take some pictures of the stadium for the piece that I was doing, and they had like a yoga instructor leading the entire team in yoga on the field, and I thought that was pretty interesting.
I'm curious to hear from you, Joel. Like, if there's any, like, what's the big, if there even, or what the biggest storyline going into the season? Whether that's, you know, youth, is it Matt Garza and kind of the comments he made at the end of last season, the kind of a rift that it sounded like there was between him and the front office, or just, hey, maybe we have a shot. Like, is there any kind of one overarching storyline to the team?
I mean, I would say a couple things. First of all, you know, my initial response is youth. I mean, that's just that's the narrative. That's where they're going. I've just been looking at videos. They seem to have a pretty cohesive clubhouse just from what I've seen. But, you know, that's obviously a pretty outside perspective. There's also what they're going to do with LaCroix. I feel like I'm mispronouncing his name. LaCroix. He's obviously gone, and he's talked about, you know, he did say in January, he said that he wants to be traded to a winner. He kind of backed off that and said, you know, I'm going to be a role model like players have been for me. Jason Kendall, I think, is who he cited. So I think that he's backed off that, but they're still like, you know, thanks, but see you later. Not because they think that he's a bad guy, but they could probably get a lot for a catcher who, you know, 2 years ago was fourth in the NL MVP and had a warp of like 6.7 or something like that. So, you know, I think that I have no doubt that he'll be traded, and then they'll just continue on this path of rebuilding around youth. And they seem to be, everything I've seen says that the players they're picking up are promising, especially this shortstop. So, you know, so we'll see, but I think they're on the right track.
Does it make you wonder at all with LaCroix's comments how out of touch sometimes players are? I mean, he comes and says in the offseason, hey, I want to be traded, and everybody kind of goes, well, duh, you're going to be traded. So why say it if it's a foregone conclusion? It just makes you wonder whether or not you know, these players are maybe not as in touch sometimes as we give them credit for.
Yeah, I hear that.
Well, thanks for running us through the Brewers, but I am disappointed. I'm looking at the depth chart, and I see that there's a reliever whose name is David Goforth, and you didn't work that in any way. That's really disappointing.
God, I feel like I let you down. I'm really sorry about that.
Well, there's next week if you're still around.
Okay.
moving right along, let's go to the Cincinnati Reds, and Kat, our guest for tonight, has the Reds. Tell us what you found, Kat.
It was ugly last year, as we saw. The Reds finished with 98 losses, which they were the second losingest team under the Phillies. So for them to be, the thing that I found the most interesting was contrasted against being in the what we consider now to be the best division in baseball, where, as I pointed out in my piece, that the Cubs were only good for third place with 97 wins. So for them to only win, you know, the amount of games that they did in this division, just it looks so much worse than it would in another division for them. And the thing is that it's going to continue that way in 2016, and I'm pretty sure that everyone in baseball and Reds fans are obviously very prepared for that, especially after the offseason that they've had. You know, I mean, they've pretty much dismantled the core of the team. I mean, they lost Aroldis Chapman, they traded Todd Frazier, and in my opinion, before I looked into it, I didn't think that they got the best end of the prospects on that. Now that I've actually dug a little deeper into it, they got a good side of the prospects. I just am not sure if I think the Dodgers may have done better on that side. But, you know, and then the thing for them is when you went into the season knowing that it was going to be bad because they were going through a rebuilding phase, then the pieces that they had, they suffered injuries. You know, Homer Bailey, they haven't seen him on the mound for a full season in, I think it's 2 years now. Then they lost Devin Mesoraco after 51 games. And then shortly after that, they lost Zach Cozart. So it took a team that was that's outlook already was poor and made it worse. So with that, I think it made them, I think they could have done a little better, obviously, had these other players stayed on the field. But now that they're going to be coming back this season, the thing we're looking at is that they've lost more talent. So it's almost like it's not even really going to help propel them into more wins. But one thing I did point out is that if they're able to get everyone on the field, which the way the injuries panned out, they'll have everyone back on the field before the All-Star break. I know they're looking probably to trade, you know, Jay Bruce and potentially Brandon Phillips if they can get him to not... I know he has a lot of no-trade clauses.
Be a jerk.
If they can wait and kind of keep that core together, this is just my idea. If they can keep that core together and kind of stash away as many wins as possible when they have as much talent on the field as they're going to get this season, that might... I'm not saying that that's going to be any of any significance for them in the division because they're obviously not going to be contending, but it may just not reflect as badly for them. I mean, the goal is obviously they want to keep fans coming to the ballpark. They want to keep people in the seats. During a rebuild phase, fans have to be on board with that. You know, when the White Sox were rebuilding, you know, in 2013, I was still going to a bunch of games. You know, the fans really have to be there to support them. But at the same time, if they're not giving them something to come out and see besides Joey Votto, it's really hard to kind of want to spend your money. So if they can kind of keep that core together for a little bit, I don't know, I'm just thinking that maybe it would help them keep face a little bit. But I think they really are, if they are all in on this rebuilding, which obviously at this point they are, they're going to need to trade Jay Bruce, and they're going to have to figure out something with Brandon Phillip, because I don't think they're going to be trading Joey Votto. That obviously is on the table just because of Joey Votto and what he stands for, but I don't believe that it's something that they're actually going to want to pursue, because from a team that would be interested in him standpoint, he's going into his age 33 season, and he has an 8-year contract, I believe it is. And even though it's pretty team-friendly for what Joey Votto is now, he's going to be going down on the aging curve, and he's not going to be producing at the level that he is now for much longer. So from the Reds' standpoint, are they really going to want to keep him on this team, knowing that when their window of contention opens, he's not going to be producing at this level most likely, because he's probably not going to be, he's going to be 35 or 36 by the time that they're in any sort of shape to contend. But one thing that I did notice when I was reading the Reds' article or essay in the annual was that Russell Carlson, who wrote the essay, pointed out that relative to Joey Votto's performance, the type of player he is, his age, other players, you know, with the same career track have not, they've got 2/3, I think he said it was, of a chance to continue producing past Joey Votto's age at this all-star level, but they also have, I think it was a 70% chance to be producing at above average. So if you think about it that way, the Reds are still definitely going to be benefiting from him, you know, a few years down the road. So I think that's what they're thinking, is that no one's probably going to want to take on this contract considering the context of Joey Votto's age and, you know, all that. So they might as well keep him, because right now he's going to help give this team, you know, some sort of talent. He's going to help keep fans in the seats and, you know, all that good stuff. And down the road, he's still going to be contributing at above average levels. I mean, that's more than you could ask for the situation that they're in right now. So, I mean, when I did my essay, I tried to make sure that I kept all the Joey Votto talk to a limit, because I feel like when people talk about the Reds, that's kind of the only thing that they bring up, because there's not really much to talk about right now. So,
sad trombone.
Yeah, I was actually surprised when I did my preview. I think I kept my talk of Joey Votto under 250 words, and the piece is almost 2,000 words, so that's pretty good. So they got pretty good prospect return for what they did give up, though, in the offseason. So the future is looking good. I know they have Cody Reed, who's looking to be a solid starter. You know, he's in Double-A right now. I believe that's where he's going to start the season. He recently got reassigned to minor league camp. So he's looking really good for them. And if they do find themselves in a position where they can trade Brandon Phillips, they have Jose Peraza, who's definitely ready to move into second base, and he's not just going to be a body that they can put there. He's actually going to be able to hold his own there and perform there. And he's been willing. I know he's a natural shortstop. I believe he's a natural shortstop, or he was one in Atlanta, and he was willing to make the move to second base. So he's definitely prepared to take on that position in the middle infield. So that wouldn't necessarily be a problem. And then the rest of the prospects they got are just kind of going to be hanging out in the minors and, you know, getting themselves together, because, you know, they have a few years until they're going to need to seriously start to contribute on the field. I mean, this is definitely probably the ugliest part of the rebuilding phase for the Reds. So, I mean, that's pretty much it. People are just going to have to understand that, you know, they're rebuilding and you got to do this. It's just something the teams have to go through every once in a while. The Cubs went through it. You know, I watched the Sox go through it. The Brewers are going through it right now. It's just, that's baseball.
So, Kat, how many wins do you have for the Reds this year?
I'm going to be a little nicer to them and say that, actually, no, I'm going to say they're going to go with 62, because that rotation is just, I'm going to peg them for 100 losses.
Dang.
Wow. Well, that rotation is just going to be so questionable, especially before Homer Bailey comes back. I mean, when they, after the All-Star break last year, when they started just bringing out all those young arms and just kind of going for it, that's kind of what they're going to be doing this year, too. So, I mean, that's not looking good for them.
So, one more question for you. Last week, I was hanging out with a couple of diehard Red fans who actually had some pretty realistic...
I thought you were going to say you were hanging out with Joey Votto.
Yeah. I don't know if he's a diehard Reds fan or not at this point. But they actually had fairly realistic expectations for where their team was. And, of course, they sounded like Cubs fans in 2013, where it was all about the rebuild and all about the prospects. And it just struck me, as I kind of did some due diligence on what they were saying, that when I look at their rebuild compared to where the Cubs were 2 years ago, I don't see the impact players to actually say, hey, in 4 or 5 years, this team will be there, maybe even in 2 years, as they were saying. You look at the top, and I like Robert Stevenson. He throws really hard. He doesn't throw strikes enough, maybe. There's a couple of decent positional prospects, Jesse Winker and, as you mentioned, Peraza. But what do you think as far as their trajectory and whether or not they're actually putting together the pieces to be a future contender with the Pirates and Cubs, who both look like they're going to be awesome for 6 or 7 years?
See, yeah, that definitely is something that I was looking at. Is you're right, there aren't really any impact players or names in their minor league system right now. But the one thing that you, I guess the kind of positive outlook on that is that they are somewhat of a developmental organization. I mean, they've brought quite a few players up. I believe they brought Todd Frazier up through that system. They brought Homer Bailey up through that system. Not that I'm saying that these are going to be people like, or players that, you know, like the Cubs have, like the Chris Bryants and the Addison Russells of the world. But I guess what I'm thinking is that perhaps they can take these prospects that they have and kind of help mold them into what they think that they can be. And I definitely think 2 years is definitely, that's not going to work. Mm-hmm. It's going to be at least 3 years for them. So yeah. That's kind of the way I'm looking at it, is maybe they can sort of manipulate this to work in their favor. Mm-hmm. But you're right, there definitely is a lack of impact talent in their organization.
I guess it highlights that this year and next year and the year after that in the draft, they're really going to have to hit on their top draft picks.
They really are. And the thing is that they're going to have to start wondering is, you know, they're going to, obviously they're not in a position to contend anytime soon. And with the Cubs and the Cardinals and even the Pirates right now being as good as they are, they're going to kind of have to, I hate to say it, but wait for those teams' window of contention to close in order for them to capitalize and kind of go for it. And they need to position themselves now to be ready for that. And like you said, I just don't know that the talent in that system is kind of putting them in the best position right now. But we'll see with the draft and what they do, perhaps with the talent over the next the few trades that hopefully they'll make this year. So,
Good stuff.
Yeah, just real quick, I guess, if it's going to be 3 years for them, does it really make sense for them? I mean, should they be looking to move Votto if they could? I mean, it doesn't make sense for them to be rebuilding and keeping a guy who will be 36 when they realistically have a chance to contend again.
I think they're going to be listening to any offers that come up, or, I mean, everything's on the table. I don't think it's like a hard no that they don't want to trade him. It probably has something to do with the progression of, you know, where they see themselves in the next couple of years. You know, I feel like it's always going to be on the table because, yeah, the return for someone like Votto, if it's the right deal, you just don't say no to that when you're in the middle of a rebuild.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Well, let's go from the two teams that are clearly in rebuilding phases. And the thing I liked about watching the Reds, at least, was you had these two guys with incredible tools. Chapman, just throwing 100 miles an hour, he's gone. And Billy Hamilton, who, great speed, but that's kind of wearing thin now that he can't get on base. But let's go into the rest of the division, the three teams that are expected to, you know, be right out there at the top. And let's start with Isaac and the Pirates.
Well, I took the Pirates because it's been pretty interesting for me to watch what a small market team has done to become a contender year in and year out now for the last 3 years. They also strike me as the classic example of, do you want to look at the glass half full or the glass half empty? This is a team that hasn't won a central division or a division title in any way since 1992. So you're talking 24 seasons with no division titles. And the cynic would maybe say, you know, we've never been able to get over the hump. Look what happened. The last couple of years, we've gotten into the wild card game, and we've gotten completely shut down by Madison Bumgarner, who went on to have probably the best postseason in history. And then last year, they got shut down by Jake Arrieta, who was in the midst of probably the greatest second half run in history for starting pitchers. So that's what the cynic would say. You know, we're just getting hosed here. We keep landing in the wild card game no matter how many games we win, and it's one and done. We haven't won a title in 24 years. But the optimist might look at it the other way and say, look at what we've done with a small payroll. It's going to be under $100 million again this year. You know, just nowhere near the income that some of the bigger market teams in their division, like the Cubs and the Cardinals, have. And say, well, look, this is great. You know, we won 98 games last year. We were second place. We had the second best record in baseball. So it really just depends on how you look at it for the Pirates. And when you look at the moves they made this offseason, I think that their front office took the optimistic approach and said, hey, look, our core of Andrew McCutchen, Gerrit Cole, Starling Marte has just been completely dominant, and we don't need to make that many moves because the team is really good, and we just need a little bit of luck, or you know, to be blessed a little bit more in the playoffs with the way things fall, or maybe not, you know, face the Cy Young winner again. I don't know. I like some of the moves they've made. They make sense. They added John Jaso to platoon with Michael Morse at first base, which Jaso crushes righties, but he can't hit lefties at all, so he'll be in there most days against righties. But on the flip side of that, he's never played first base. So you're talking about transitioning catcher to first base, and Michael Morse isn't a good fielder either, so that could be a weakness. On the pitching side of the equation, they lost A.J. Burnett, who was really good for them last year. He was definitely a cog behind Gerrit Cole and Francisco Liriano, and they replaced him with a combination that might make you cringe, Jonathan Neese. I mean, the trade was Todd Walker for Jonathan Neese. It's kind of a classic challenge trade, a trade for positional need. I just don't love what he brings to the table as the number three starter. We talked about this a little bit last week, and the more I dug into his numbers, they've really been regressing, and the peripherals don't line up for him to be all that great either. They also added Ryan Vogelsong, who his whip was awful last year at 1.46. His ERA was about 4.7. They also retained Jeff Locke, who was pretty horrible last year as well. So I don't know. After Cole and Liriano, I think the starting rotation has some serious questions. So I touched on the outfield. It's Marte, McCutchen, and Gregory Polanco across, which is extremely solid. It's probably the best defensive outfield in baseball right now. Marte and McCutchen are both superstars, and Polanco certainly could be. And then you look at the infield, and this, is where it starts to get questionable, and I started to doubt myself in believing that they were a superpower team and one of the best three or four teams in baseball. The infield across is Jaso and Morse at first. You've got Jung Ho Gung at third. You've got Jordy Mercer at short, and you've got Josh Harrison at second. So if you compare that to the Cubs infield of Bryant, Russell, Ben Zobrist, and Anthony Rizzo, it's pretty staggering. I mean, the Cubs have a couple of top 10 MVP guys and Rizzo and Bryant, and they've got Addison Russell, and you all know how I feel about Russell. And then Ben Zobrist, who it doesn't get any more solid than Zobrist. So when you can compare that group to what the Pirates have, it's kind of amazing, actually, that they won more games than we did last year. So all in all, it's a very interesting team. It seems very top-heavy, like the players at the top are strong, very solid, with McCutchen and Cole and Marte, and then it drops off pretty huge after that. So all in all, their goal is very clear: win the NL Central, stay out of the wild card game, and find themselves in the NLDS for the first time in a very long time. But as you know, even though the Cardinals' reign just kind of ended, in my opinion, I think they're going to not win the NL Central for the first time in 5 years. You see the Cubs coming up. So one kind of reign ended, and the next one just started on the Pirates.
So I was just asking about the two pitchers that are the two young prospects. It's Jameson Taillon and what's the name of the other guy?
Tyler Glasnow.
Yeah, so those two guys, do you think they're gonna be used as starters to kind of help with the pitching side, or could they be flipped for, you know, if they see some issues offensively with the infield that you just mentioned?
Yeah, great question. I actually touch on this in my piece at length. I think they have to keep them. They need to get by on their infield because I think the back end of their rotation, starting with the three spot, is actually a bigger need than their infield is. It's not that their infield is necessarily bad. It's just not good, I don't think. But I think the back end of their rotation has the possibility of being bad. It looks to me like they brought in a bunch of guys that they think Ray Searidge can really improve upon, but I'm just not seeing it. Juan Nicasio was the other name that I should have touched on. They brought in Nicasio as well. So he's the only one that I see maybe some Searidge magic working with his velocity. But I think they need to actually keep Glasnow and get him into the rotation. I think by May or June, he'll be in the rotation as the other guys falter. And I think that's the bigger need than anything on the infield will be.
Okay, that makes sense. So how many wins do you have them up for?
Oh, I went back and forth on this quite a bit. Let's say 91.
That sounds about right to me. Yeah, I'm actually
I think it's a little bit high.
Yeah, I'm a little bit higher on the Pirates than I think most people are, but that's because I think Glasnow does come up fairly early in the season, maybe like May or early June, and I think that a rotation of Cole, Liriano, Glasnow, Jonathan Neese as your number four, and then either Locke or Ryan Vogelsong, whoever's pitching better, I guess, as your number five. That's a pretty good rotation, and they have the best outfield in the majors, probably. Maybe the Red Sox give them a little challenge for that, but overall, I think they're still a really good team. I think they overachieved a little bit in 2015, but you know, the Cubs and the Cardinals did too, so around 90 wins is probably appropriate, I think.
Yeah, and I'm not necessarily saying that they're not a good team. I do think they're a good team, hence the 91 win. I just don't think they're going to approach 98 again. I think they overachieved last year in many areas. And I can hear you, and that's kind of the glass half full on the rotation. But on the empty side, that's counting on a guy who's never started in the majors before to be your number three. And to me, that actually makes the point of saying, hey, there's some weakness here in the middle if you're counting on a rookie to be that big of a cog in your rotation.
Well, sure, but I mean, I guess you could say that he's actually, you know, counting on him to be your number four, because I think that Jonathan Neese is probably as quality a number three as you're going to find. So, short of maybe the Cubs with Lackey, but
you must be higher on Neese than I am at this stage.
I think he's been extremely solid throughout his career, and I mean, he's nothing spectacular, but he's a lefty who goes and gets people out. So, I mean, I don't see what there is to dislike about Neese at this point, especially as a number three, a low-end number three or a high-end number four.
Yeah, I guess I just look at his peripherals from last year. He's dropped, in 2011, his strikeouts per nine was 7.9, and he's dropped every season since then to last year where he was 5.8, and his whip really ballooned up to 1.4 last year, and his FIP came right up with it to over 4.4. I just see a guy that can't strike anybody out and started to get hit hard last year.
Yeah, that's fair.
And Isaac mentioned the luck factor for the Pirates. They had the best record in one-run games, and they were extremely healthy, so that's something that can always change season to season. So let's go from probably the most exciting outfield in baseball to an outfield that has some question marks. Ryan, take us through the Cardinals.
All right, so to talk about the Cardinals, I have to draw all the comparisons to the Cubs and what they've done with their rebuild. The Cardinals in the 90s, if you'll remember, were kind of a big pile of crap. They had a 488 winning percentage for that decade and made the playoffs just one time in 1996 on the back of an 88-win season, and that was the most games that they won in the 90s. Walt Jocketty was hired in 1994 in October, took over the team, fired Joe Torre as manager, replaced him with Tony La Russa. So you're kind of seeing some of the parallels where he went out and got Tony La Russa, who was considered one of the best managers in baseball at that point, just like the Cubs did with Joe Maddon. He basically took a farm team that had little to nothing in it and turned it into one of the best in baseball. Traded from a position of depth to acquire a core of Mark McGwire, Fernando Tatis, Edgar Renteria, Daryl Kyle, Fernando Vina, and Jim Edmonds. He had prospects that they left on the roster, such as pitchers Matt Morris and Rick Ankiel, J.D. Drew, Placido Polanco, and Albert Pujols coming up too. So by 2000, the Cardinals had basically everything except for Pujols, who would come up the next season, ready and on the roster, and that's when they started their big run of terror in the NL Central. Over the last 16 seasons, they've averaged 91.5 wins per season, which is mind-boggling, really. They've finished under 500 only one time in those 16 years, four trips to the World Series. They won it twice. Both Jocketty and La Russa have since moved on, and the core has been so solid and the foundation so good that they've just kind of continued on. 2015, they went 162. They had major injuries to Adam Wainwright, Matt Holliday, first baseman Matt Adams, and a few relievers, Jordan Walden. But they did have some good luck, which I think a lot of Cardinals fans don't really want to point out. They had their four starters in their rotation pitch 175 innings or more, which was makes them only one of eight teams to do it in Major League Baseball, and six of those eight teams made the playoffs. So that kind of tells you how important that is. They went 51-25 in the first half of the season, but then 49-37, which is a 92-win pace the rest of the way. So that kind of tells you that they started off really hot, but their second half, while still good, was nowhere near, you know, as quality based on, you know, just kind of coming back down to, you know, kind of average level. So this offseason, of course, they lost Jason Hayward and Lance Lynn to injury, Hayward to the Cubs, Lackey to the Cubs. They got rid of Tony Cruz, Mark Reynolds, Peter Borges, John Jay, Carlos Villanueva. They brought in Mike Leake, Jed Jerko, and Ruben Tejada to replace Johnny Peralta, who got injured in spring training. I think that the Cardinals are difficult to kind of put your finger on, because everyone says that because they're aging and their farm system's starting to dry up and all the injury concerns, they should be falling off this year. And I think there were a lot of people who said they should be falling off last year too. They won 100 wins, which kind of surprised a lot of people. And this year everyone says, okay, now is the year that they fall off, because they lost Hayward and Lackey. Nobody's expecting anything out of them. It kind of reminded me, and I didn't write about this in my preview, but I thought about this after I finished it, the comparison with the early 2000s Braves. If you remember the long run that they went on, in 2003, they won 101 games and were kind of at the back end of that run. They had Vinny Castilla at third base. They had Javi Lopez at catcher, hit 43 home runs, had a monster year. They had Maddox in the rotation. Smoltz was the closer, but they had just lost Glavin. Gary Sheffield was in right field, and then they lost like all of those guys, either to free agency or they traded or whatever, and everyone said, okay, 2004, now is the time when the Braves finally don't win the division. It's going to be either the Phillies or the Marlins. Braves are done. And they came back and they won 96 games in 2004. And then they won 90 games in 2005. And then it wasn't until 2006 that they actually had their streak. I think they went 15 or 16 seasons of winning the division, had it broken. So that's a comparison that I kind of see with the Cardinals, where, yeah, they have injury concerns with Wainwright and Waka and Martinez and Garcia. Any single one of them could go down with an injury, and they'd probably be in trouble because they don't have a whole lot of rotation depth. But I just see that they've figured something out, and it's hard to put your finger on or hard to quantify, because, you know, Pakota has projected them. I think Randall Grichuk and Stephen Piscotty, who put up like a combined 3.6 WARP in 606 combined plate appearances last year. They're only projected for 4 combined WARP in over 1,100 plate appearances this year. So they're projected quite lower. I think dropped a ball. Matt Carpenter is projected for like 2.6 WARP this year after putting up 4.8 last year, and I think 7.3 2 years before that. I mean, the projections are much lower on these guys than they've actually been doing the last several years. So it's difficult for me to look at it and say, you know, on one hand, everything seems to be piling up to say that this team shouldn't be winning again this year. But at the same time, we've seen this before in different, you know, iterations of other teams, and we know what a solid base the Cardinals have and what a fine-tuned organization that they have. Should be really believing that this team is just going to, you know, show up and win 85 games this year and, you know, kind of put their hands in their pockets and say, well, it's the Cubs division now. I don't think that's necessarily true. So I think that they're probably going to win somewhere around 90 games, maybe as many as 95 if everything goes right.
Ugh. Yeah, ugh.
Yeah, I was really hoping this is the year, man. 78 wins tops.
Yeah, that would be nice.
Yeah,
I thought I'd bring everybody down with that.
What we really want to know, Ryan, is what are the penalties going to be for the hacking scandal?
cut off all their players' right arms. That's my.
That's my dramatic.
Idea. I don't know. That seems a little over the top. Maybe, yeah, maybe left, but
that seems
maybe,
about right.
Maybe we could just contract them from the league. I'd be okay with that.
They'd still win 92 games, Dave Perbecky style.
Or just nuke St. Louis. Could we do that? I'd be okay with that.
No, Adam Wainwright.
Yeah.
Well, one of the big storylines last year was the monumental amount of injuries that they had, and how was it that they won this many games with that many injuries? I mean, is that something that they're kind of counting on more health than last year for this year? Because I mean, they're counting on an awful lot, like you said, from Grichuk and from Piscotty.
Yeah, as far as like rotation help, they have a really weak depth in their rotation. They have Tyler Lyons and Marco Gonzalez and Tim Cooney, who are basically their entire rotation depth if anybody gets hurt. Those guys have like 32 combined starts in the majors and like a 4.85 ERA combined. So that tells you it's not very good. And then Marco Gonzalez himself has, you know, shoulder issues too. So, but injuries on the field, I don't know if they're counting on Matt Holliday as much. He isn't a guy who's been hurt a lot in his career, but he was hurt last year. Didn't hit for a lot of power, but still got on base at like a 390 clip. So I think that they're looking at Moss and Matt Adams being back healthy, and they picked up Tejada, they picked up Jerko. I think that they probably are just kind of crossing their fingers on the positional side. As you kind of mentioned, when you let in the outfield defense is going to be terrible. It's going to be an awful dumpster fire in the outfield. With,
I mean, say it once.
Yeah, Piscotty is going to be fine in right field, but Hayward. I'm sorry, not Hayward.
he's not a leader.
Yeah, Grichuk in center field and Holliday in left is terrible. I mean, that's as bad as it gets for an outfield. And but you know, I still think that Matt Carpenter's a hell of a ball player, and I really like Colton Wong. I think this might be the year that he breaks out. And you know, Piscotty's a decent player. Grichuk's a decent player, although I expect regression for them too. I think just having maybe Holliday back healthy and Adams back healthy, they may score just enough runs to be average in Major League Baseball. And if their rotation stays healthy, which it mostly did last year, minus Wainwright, that's a pretty good starting rotation too, and you can't count out Cardinals Devil Magic either. So
I wanted to say that. I was waiting the whole time to say that.
Sorry.
My thunder.
Don't you mean hacking magic?
Yes.
haven't we debunked this myth of Devil Magic?
Yeah, the Devil Magic's been there. Yeah, the Devil Magic's been there for years. Yeah, I still think that this team has. I think what I wrote down was they have enough talent. As far as just pure talent, they're as talented as any other team in baseball. Their problems are whether that talent's going to stay healthy and whether they're going to start regressing with age. If they don't start regressing with age and they stay healthy, this is probably going to be a really fun race between the Cubs, the Cardinals, and the Pirates.
Well, I don't know that I'd like it to be fun as much as it was just a dumpster fire would be fine from the Cardinals.
I'd be fine with that too.
It'd be great to dance on their grave for a while, but I'd love to see a Cubs Cardinals NLCS. As much as I'd be vomiting, I'd probably lose a whole bunch of weight.
Cat's fitting in real nice on this one. I like it. So let's jump into the Cubs real quick. And you know, what can you say about the Cubs? This is a Cubs podcast. We've talked a lot about them, but I thought a good place to start was to just kind of run through some of the changes in the opening day starting lineup from last year. You know, David Ross was starting because John Lester was pitching. We'll have Montero there catching Arrieta. Rizzo will be at first, no change. Tommy La Stella started last year at second base. We'll have Ben Zobrist this year. It's a big difference. Mike Olt was starting at third base. We'll have Chris Bryant. Shortstop, instead of Starlin Castro, we'll have Addison Russell. Left field, we had Chris Coughlin. Now we'll have Kyle Schwarber. Dexter Fowler will still be in center. And in right field, Jason Hayward. So just going through those changes, like that's a, and granted, the roster turned over quite a bit during the season last year, but just when I saw the differences in just the starting lineup for opening day, it really struck me how different and how improved this team is. And that's great. And I think you'll see. I'm curious to hear what you guys think about my projected win total, and I'll get to that at the end. But a lot of things went well for them last year. They ranked third in one-run games. They ranked second in extra inning games. They were very healthy. I think the player that I've quoted this before, but mangameslost.com kind of puts together injuries per team and which players affected the team the most by their injury, by war lost, and it was Mike Olt, which allowed Chris Bryant to come up. So that they were very fortunate there. Their cluster luck was another thing, and this was, going back to the Cardinals for a little bit, one of the reasons that they were able to overcome all those injuries last year. There's a great piece by Ben Lindbergh on restinpeacegrantland.com where he covered cluster luck and how fortunate the Cardinals were. The Cubs were also fortunate, not as much as the Cardinals, but they definitely they were on the positive in that number. The Cubs are going to get plenty of wins. They've got all this talent. They've got a lot of dry powder in case something happens, be it an injury or performance that they need to replace a player. They've got Baez as the super utility player. They've got Soler, who will probably be, you know, playing some right field, playing some left field, whenever Kyle Schwarber is catching or a tough lefty is on the mound. But they've got all this flexibility, and they've got all these players on the roster that they can pretty much cover those things that come up throughout the course of the season. I'm pegging the Cubs for 93 wins. And I'm curious if you guys feel that that's low or not. I kind of went from their win total last year. I took them down a notch based on all these things that kind of went their way. But they did improve the team a lot. So I bumped them back up. And I think if my win projection and Ryan's kind of happen in his range between 90 and 95, they're going to be pretty much right next to each other. And I'm curious what you guys think about that.
Yeah, if I were to make a win total prediction, I would say 90 to 95 for the Cubs as well. So I think you're pretty much spot on. 93 doesn't shock me, either too low or too high. Kind of touching on what you said about kind of the depth that the Cubs have, I was watching the game today on Comcast with my dad, and he was kind of commenting about he had gone out to spring training last week, and that he thought, oh man, there's just so many players. He can never remember at the time in his life where the Cubs had so many great players. And you know, he kind of, the incident with the bees happened with Jason Hayward today, and he was kind of joking about that would just be Cubs luck to lose their star outfielder that they stole from the Cardinals because he got attacked by a swarm of bees. And I was like, hey, you know, it's funny, but, you know, if Jason Hayward went down for any kind of significant amount of time, that would suck. But the Cubs have four great outfielders to take three spots. So, you know, they have finally a team that's good enough that they could lose somebody for a significant amount of time, which they really didn't last year. They could have that happen and not, you know, have the entire team go down the toilet. So, yeah, I think... barring a massive disaster, like a sniper at the All-Star game, the Cubs are going to win 90 to 95 wins.
You know, Carlos, it's funny you mentioned kind of using last year's record as kind of a benchmark. I know that it wasn't etched in stone, but I remember seeing a Twitter war between two guys. It got pretty heated talking about whether or not you can use last year's numbers as anything, or if you just start from scratch. And I read the article about, you know, cluster luck and injuries and one-run games, and so I know that they did get lucky, but they also improved fairly dramatically, you know, what with Zobrist and Lackey and Hayward right there, you know. So I don't know. I'm not going to say that they're going to win, 103, but I feel like, and I know that, you know, mathematically you're supposed to just start from scratch and not bring in last year's total at all, but I feel like I'm really bullish on this team. I mean, I feel like Christina Carl said she called them a team without a weakness, and, you know, that's, I don't think that's inaccurate to say that. Like, what's their weakness? Like, Rondon, well, I mean, he looked a little shaky in the spring training, but he was pretty awesome last year. And maybe at the end of the rotation, well, what team doesn't have that problem? So, you know, I'm aiming high. I think that I'm thinking 95 plus.
You know what, you're right, Joel. And I guess I think part of me is I'm usually an optimist, but when I hear everybody else around me being so optimistic about this team, I get a little scared. And I've been reading and have something that I've been trying to write about the Nationals from last year and how they were the team that had no weaknesses. They signed Max Scherzer and they had to put, I can't remember the guy's name, they had to take him out of the rotation even though he had pitched wonderfully the season before. And look what happened, right? So whenever I hear everything get too positive, I feel like I want to bring it down a notch just to kind of get us back to reality. I'd rather be pleasantly surprised than disappointed. So I think that's part of what's going on with me here.
Let me just jump in and say this. The one insurance against that is Joe Maddon.
Yeah, it could be. And I'm with you, Carlos. I'm actually working on a piece as well titled Curb Your Enthusiasm because... This game is baseball, and to your Nationals point, you simply never know what's going to happen, and the helium in Chicago is really starting to get to me, and I think 93 wins is a perfectly acceptable number. It's probably exactly where I would have put it as well, however, I do think that there's a delta with this team. I think the delta is probably somewhere around 85 wins on the extreme 10 percentile low area. And I think the 90th percentile is probably something enormous, like 104, where if we're healthy and everything goes right, it's a team that just absolutely slays the competition. So, but I think 93 is a really good area to put it in.
Yeah, that's one thing is I know you, Isaac, and I looked into the 90th and 10th percentile Pecota projections this year. So we kind of really dug into just how bad it could get. And not that it's going to get that bad, but that it is a possibility. And that whenever a team wins 97 games, you do have to peg them for a little regression. But, you know, as you guys were saying, they did add significant talent. They have great depth. There's pretty much insurance in almost every aspect. But the one thing I do want to say is that since we all know that Jake Arrieta is not going to repeat that season that he had last year, we have to kind of remember that a couple of those wins... you have to pretty much put on his shoulders in some way. So yeah. Maybe it's a little out there for me to kind of say that a few of the wins were solely on his shoulders because they weren't. But if he's going to regress and he was such a big part of, you know, that team's success, you have to expect a little of that to be reflected in the standings, even if it's just a couple games, you know.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. Essentially, I think you're saying that there's nowhere to go but down from what he did.
Pretty much. I mean, it would be crazy if he even came close to repeating that season.
Mm-hmm.
No. I mean, he's going to have to come down to earth a little bit, but the thing that's so awesome is that when he does come back down to earth, he's still going to be absolutely incredible.
Yeah.
I actually wrote something for a different site about Jake Arrieta and what kind of regression we could actually realistically expect. So I think what I basically found was based on a lot of his peripheral stats, things that you could actually expect to regress really only takes you back to what he was in 2014. And what he was in 2014 is still one of the top five pitchers in baseball. So yeah, I don't think... you know, even if you do expect that he will, there's no way he could get better or even stay at that level. You know, you're still talking about one of the best pitchers in the game. Nobody should be able to complain about that.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of coming down to earth, one segment that never comes down to earth is our 60 Seconds with a Former Cub.
Wow.
Perfect transition.
Sometimes it's there, but we'll let it slide.
Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
Middlewald.
What do we have?
George Middlewald.
Hey, that was the gold standard.
Fool's gold.
So do you want me to just get rocking here?
The stopwatch is ready. Set.
Okay.
Go.
Louisiana native Lee Arthur Smith stood 6'6" and he racked up 180 saves over his 8-year career with the Cubs in the mid-1980s. He always seemed like he was exhausted and in agony, like his joints were all rusted and corroded. And then he'd unleash that 95-mile-an-hour heater, and that, more often than not, would be that. Smith came up with the Cubs in the 1980s, a middle reliever and a starter, and he was, well, not good. Then he was converted to a closer, and that's what he did for the next 15 years. He had many big saves for the Cubs, but we old-timers will never quite forgive him for that 2-run Steve Garvey homer he gave up in Game 4 of the 1984 NLCS. Smith stayed with the Cubs until 1987, with GM Jim Fry sending him to Boston for relievers Al Nipper and Calvin Schiraldi. Hey, anytime you can trade for two guys who completely destroyed a team's chance at a World Series title, you have to go for it. Smith went on to record 298 more saves over his career, earning the then all-time record for saves. He's still not in the Hall of Fame, though, which is a big point of controversy for many fans.
Boom.
Man, that put Mitterwald to shame.
that would actually be maybe at some point when the season is really slow, which probably will not happen, or maybe at the end of the season, we could look at his Hall of Fame chances, because that's a really – his case is really interesting.
Are we still talking about Mitterwald?
did we ever stop?
No.
So, he was the all-time leader in saves, but he wasn't dominant if you actually look at his numbers. And he had a lot of blown saves, too. At one point, his save percentage was in the 70s. So, I don't know. You don't have to get into the knot, obviously.
Finished Lee Smith with a downward angle, huh?
That's the Joel specialty.
I was going to say that, Carlos. I think the only reason that, you're maybe saying 93 wins and you feel pessimistic is I think this podcast is starting to influence you. I think it's getting to you, man.
Oh, boy. Well, I do have my daughter's bedroom is filled with bottled water and blankets now, so maybe that's what it is.
Okay.
All right, then.
Anyway. Ryan, help me out here. Did anybody ask any questions this week?
Yes, we did have one question. Actually, more than one. So this is the best one, though. It comes from Matt Milton, whose Twitter handle is @MatthewGeorge. He says, if the bullpen doesn't work out, which I think is the biggest weakness, who do we see as likely trade candidates at the deadline? And I thought it'd be fun if we each came up with who we thought might be a trade candidate, and the guy that I picked is Jake McGee, who formerly of the Tampa Bay Rays traded to the Colorado Rockies. He was the closer for the Rays last two seasons, pitched a combined over 108 innings, had a 2.07 ERA with a 1.94 FIP, with 2.0 walks per nine and 11.4 strikeouts per nine. Basically as dominating as a reliever gets, especially a left-handed reliever. And I think that he will definitely be on the trade block if he's healthy, regardless of what the kind of numbers he puts up in Colorado, because everybody knows, what he can do. And frankly, I don't see any reason why the Colorado Rockies need a closer, because their team is absolutely terrible. So I see Jake McGee is the number one relief name on the pitching market.
Good one. I'm really tempted, just out of spite, for your Cardinals segment to say Trevor Rosenthal when they're like 15 games under 500 in July.
I'd be extremely happy with that if you would do that. Yeah, that'd be perfectly fine.
Yeah, I think I'll go off the reservation, though, here. And I actually expect this team to be pretty good, but if you're looking for surplus, I think you have to look to the Yankees, where last year they talked about trading Andrew Miller a little bit in the middle of the year. So I think one of Aroldis Chapman or Andrew Miller could be out there, simply because that team is so overweight in the bullpen and they've got some other areas of need. And if the season maybe isn't going well, they can trade them off for young prospects. Or even if it is going well, but they feel like their team is not balanced, they could move one of their stud relievers for another bat or another rotation arm or something of that nature.
Oh, man, if they got Aroldis Chapman, though, oh, my God, I would be like a giddy little girl. I love him so much. That would be so cool.
Be watching 103-mile-an-hour fastballs all summer.
Oh, man.
I'd want them to go after a guy like Carter Capps. I just want to see that funky delivery, see how people react to it.
Wow, outlawed already, right?
Oh, man.
All right, so from now, let's go to Isaac and our stat of the week. What are we looking at today, Isaac?
The stat of the week is win probability added, WPA. For readers of the site for Wrigleyville, you'll know that we use WPA in our game recaps to highlight the top play and bottom play of the game. What win probability added does is it captures the change in win expectancy for every play. So for every additive, there is a subtraction. So in other words, if Ben Zobrist comes up in the first inning and hits a double and it's plus 5%, then the pitcher also receives minus 5% for that. So every game is going to have a positive of 50 and a negative of 50% per se. For WPA, it's an interesting stat. It's not very predictive, as in it's essentially a clutch measurement, so it's not terribly predictive from year to year, but it's an excellent stat to capture what happened on the field and what moments were the biggest and where the momentum swings were and, you know, who made a good pitch win and who had a big hit win. And oftentimes WPA doesn't necessarily just come into play at the end of the game. A lot of times the biggest plays will be in the third or fourth or fifth inning, which is part of the beauty of baseball, is that, you know, the defining play can come at any moment. It could happen on the first pitch of the first inning. So WPA is a different way to look at the game for people that haven't looked at it before, and it's just a really fun measurement to really know who was clutch in a certain game and who wasn't. And then I'll finish this with a trivia question for you, is who was the best player in baseball last year by measure of WPA?
We could probably guess at this all day.
George Mederwald.
George Mederwald.
I'm going to go with Jason Hayward.
A good guess, but no. One more guess.
Pujols.
Not really a good guess, but no.
Mike Trout.
Mike Trout. Low-hanging fruit. Number one in baseball by a lot, nearly a full win, was Anthony Rizzo.
Wow.
Yep. So he had 7.15 win percentage added, win probability added, excuse me. One thing you should keep in mind, too, is this is not like WAR, where it's a replacement level statistic. This is actually from average. So essentially an average would be zero. So he added 7.15 wins to the Cubs total. Second place was Bryce Harper at 6.16. So there's a full run difference. It essentially tells you that Rizzo was very clutch last year.
Which is not necessarily predictive.
That's specifically why I like that statistic, because it shows you sort of isolated how clutch these players have been. Like, it gives you a measurement. And I remember the first time I read in Baseball Between the Numbers, the baseball prospectus book, the chapter on WPA, I was like, wow, this is awesome. Like, this is so awesome.
Yeah, it is. And actually, if you look at Fangraph's description of it as well, they rate an excellent player as plus 6 and then a great player as plus 3. And it seems like a big disparity until you actually go look at the leaderboard. The 12th best player in the game was Curtis Granderson last year, and he had a 3.94. So it goes from Rizzo's 7.15 to 3.94 really fast. And you also have to note that Chris Bryant had just under 6 at 5.99. So we have the Cubs, I'll correct myself there, Ryan. The Cubs have two of the top five players in WPA, and they're two of only nine players that are above 5. So between those two, it's actually pretty staggering that they're, you know, hitting back-to-back in the same order.
Yeah, and I think it's really cool the way the stat kind of puts into numbers what we all kind of suspect. I think anyone who watched the Cubs closely last year and, you know, felt like Anthony Rizzo had, you know, a lot of big hits or a lot of, you know, big moments in games where he drove in the tie-breaking run or, you know, tied the game up late or whatever, you know, in the playoffs hit the tie-breaking home run that, you know, when they beat the Cardinals in game 4. So, yeah, I feel like even if it's not predictive of the future, I think it does a really good job putting into one simple number, you know. Yeah, obviously, Anthony Rizzo very far and away better than anybody else at being clutch.
Well, and I might be reaching here a little bit, so one of you can feel free to yell at me if you want, but I don't. Yeah, I'm sure it'll come. I'm getting ready to get behind my little brick wall here, but I don't think that it's a coincidence that Anthony Rizzo and his two-strike approach with the way he puts the ball in play leads the league in WPA. I think there's a direct correlation between clutch and WPA and the way you approach an at-bat with two strikes, as to where if your approach is I'm going to put the ball in play, more often than not, good things happen when you cut down your strikeouts in that manner. And I believe his ability to do that in clutch situations and just get the bat on the ball is why he leads the league.
Yeah, I definitely feel like that's true because, again, in Baseball Between the Numbers, I'm not sure if it's in the chapter that's called Is David Ortiz the Best Clutch Hitter or something like that, that he talks about is there such a thing as clutch hitting. And kind of, I don't remember who exactly wrote the chapter, but he goes into that there really isn't such a thing as clutch hitting, but like you said, it's the way you change your approach at different points in the game, and you know, your two-strike approach, things like that is more what attributes to the whole clutch idea.
Yeah, and I think, Isaac, the point you made on the hitting approach, I'd be interested to see what Chris Bryant's numbers were. Because his two-strike approach is basically just going to keep doing what he does, and if he strikes out, that's okay. You know, he'll hit the occasional two-strike home run, but he'll also strike out a ton. So I'd be interested to see if that parallels the other way, where a guy with a two-strike approach that doesn't shorten his swing just to put the ball in play, if he doesn't end up with quite as many clutch hits.
And I think that's a fair assessment. What I look at with Bryant, because he's fifth in the majors at 5.99, I actually think that that number, all things considered, might come down this year because he had a couple of just huge home runs that swung it dramatically at times when the win percentage was really, really low for the Cubs. And he,
it's the Rockies.
Yeah, the Rockies one is the one that sticks out, and there's one more that's escaping me. But and I think those are actually skewing his numbers to the positive, so I wouldn't be surprised if he dropped back a little bit, you know, with the same year, all things considered. But I just think that the disparity between first and second speaks to Rizzo's approach more than anything. But I think you're right in a guy like Bryant, that he's probably due to regress in that area a little bit. I also don't think it's a coincidence that Joey Votto is third, which kind of heightens the, hey, guys with this approach with two strikes really add a lot of wins to their team.
All right, well, you know, thanks, Kat, for being on. We really appreciate you coming on and talking about the Reds. No, none of us really wanted to talk about the Reds, so that was...
Neither did I.
Very helpful. I'm sure Joel was really happy to go in depth on the Brewers, and
yes, that was awesome.
Everyone wanted to hear me talk about, you know, my love of the St. Louis Cardinals. So, anyway, you know, outside of the obvious, Kat, tell us where we can read your stuff. Even though we know BP Wrigleyville, what else?
Yes, I am fortunate enough to write with you, fine gentlemen, and I also joined the staff at the new BP Southside, the White Sox site, so if you guys haven't checked that out, I'll do a shameless plug here.
Nice.
Worth the trip over there because I do contribute. And I am a contributor at Hardball Times also, and you can find me on Twitter at the Baseball Girl, just like it sounds, even though I hate that now. Oh, but it's simple, so.
Yeah.
I've changed my Twitter handle like 5 times to find something simple because I have way too common of a name to have a Twitter handle.
How do the bots keep finding you, Ryan?
I don't know. I have like 5,400 followers and probably like 300 real ones. So,
they're like those Russian arranged marriages. Yeah.
Like, I was talking about it like I actually interact with like 50 people on Twitter. The rest of them are all just bots. Anyway, so yeah, thank you again for coming on and talking to us. And I guess you can find me at Ryan Davis BP. Isaac is at Isaac C. Bennett, at Joel C. Reese, and at Carlos Porto. And yeah, look for our Baseball Prospectus Wrigleyville previews coming out this week. And talk to you again next week. Thanks, guys.
Sounds good. See you later.
Bye.